the headlines, Iran's president says the U.S. has failed to achieve its goal of bringing down the Islamic Republic through sanctions. The United States imposes new sanctions on Syria, targeting its central bank and blacklisting several people and entities. And also in our headlines, the United Nations approves a resolution that calls on Israel to stop demolishing Palestinian homes in the occupied territories. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital town. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, Iran's president says his American counterpart has failed to achieve his goals through an economic war waged against the Islamic Republic. Hassan Rouhani called U.S. President Donald Trump a crazy man who sought to topple the Islamic establishment. In Iran, Rouhani said the Iranian nation ousted Trump with its resistance. He also said Trump was isolated even by U.S. traditional allies in Europe over his policy on Iran. The outgoing American president imposed tough sanctions on Tehran after walking out of a multilateral nuclear deal in 2018. President-elect Joe Biden has promised to rejoin the deal and seek diplomacy with Iran. For more on that, we're now joined by foreign policy analyst Paulina Aniftou, joining us from Paphos, Cyprus. Ms. Aniftou, welcome to the program. First of all, what do you make of the recent comments made by the Iranian president?
Actually, it was quite expected that Iran signed the agreement, so it was expected that this agreement is going to be executed. So United States, they withdrew without any specific justification. So at the moment, Mr. Rouhani is expecting United States, of course, to rejoin the agreement. But if United States are going to rejoin the agreement, they have to fill in their duties and their obligations according to the agreement. We cannot sit on one table about an agreement that is binding by the international laws, and from the other side, the United States not to expect to fulfill their duties and their obligations. So I think that Mr. Rouhani is tremendously aware about the duties of the United States and the duties of Iran. So I believe that it was very, very correct time, on the best time, that Biden wants to rejoin the agreement, but they have to be aware that Iran will not sit on a table without Biden. Aware about that they have to proceed and complete their awareness as well and their accountancy according to the agreement.
Well, Mr. Rouhani also said that Trump and his administration were isolated even by the U.S.'s traditional allies in Europe over his stance and his policy on Iran. How do you think that that's going to translate into the next administration? Will the playing field, in your opinion, remain the same? Will that sense of trying to restart the JCPOA also move in to President Biden's, President-elect Biden's administration?
This period, and especially the last 1 year, I believe that the assassination of General Soleimani, it was the very beginning, that all the people, there are many main allies, governments in Europe or even in South America, they understood that United States, they don't have a very clear and transparent program about their foreign policy. So the withdrawal from the agreement, the nuclear agreement, it was an incident for Trump, that Trump wanted to increase pressure on Iran. They didn't really manage. And from the other side, we see that the United States are isolated about their foreign policy in Middle East. And the Middle East foreign policy of the United States is the main axis of their policy. It is the main pillar of their foreign policy. But what we need to understand in this case is that the West doesn't have a very good understanding of Iran. What the United States, they tried to do with the assistance, of course, of Israel and some European powers, is that they believe that if they go along with the sanctions to Iran, Iran is going to collapse. We are going to have a change of government and a regimental change. What they don't understand is that Iran is a very self-sufficient economy. So in the case even of a war, Iranians are going to have water, is going to have food, and they are going to have milk, something that does not exist into the Western economies. So they confuse their economic situation and their power balance with the balance of Iran in Middle East and Eurasia. And that it was extremely mistake from the United States when they withdrew from them from the agreement, and even during 2020 when they had the assassination of Soleimani, and President Trump took it a personal responsibility about assassinating a person in a war crime action. And from the other side, we go to the explosion of Beirut, even the assassination of Fakhrizadeh. So we have to be aware that those people in the United States, foreign policy has been isolated, because all the other powers, they do understand the United States, they don't have a kind of understanding of Iran and what is Iran power in Middle East, what is Iran power globally, because we see now Iran that is helping Venezuela, is helping Bolivia. I mean, they're helping people in South Africa. So there is a kind of mixed marketing understanding from the part of the United States that they have confused capitalists with foreign policy. And this creates a kind of misunderstanding and mistreatment of Iran the last years. And so I believe that Biden knows that, but I'm not sure how possible it's going to be for him to act. I'm very sure that we're going to see the next 2-3 years elimination of the sanctions to Iran, because United States, they are collapsing to the foreign policy, so they are going to get some more credits by their allies. But from the other side, we see it in the case of Israel, that Israel is also declining demographically and is declining from the kind of power in the Middle East. So now they try not to normalize the case with the Arab monarchies, not with the Arabs. We discuss about the Arab monarchies, but what they are doing is try to officialize the good relationships they had since the war with Iraq and Iran in the 80s. So what we see in 2020 is that the United States and Israel, Trump administration got many troubles that I'm not sure that Biden can solve. But what I see is that the pressure is tremendous against the United States from the part of Russia and China, and certainly we are going to see elimination of sanctions the next 2, 3, and 4 years.
All right, thanks a lot. Foreign policy analyst Paulina Aneftu. Elsewhere, Iran has reaffirmed its opposition to any offer of renegotiation or revision of the 2015 nuclear deal. This is while the European signatories to the deal are hoping for the possible return of the U.S. to the agreement after President-elect Joe Biden takes office next month.
The United Nations Security Council has held a virtual meeting to review the 10th report into the implementation of Resolution 2231, which endorses the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. During the session on Tuesday, Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the United States for not only failing to honor its own obligations under the resolution, but also obstructing the implementation of the commitments by other signatories. Takravanchi explained that in the past 4 years, the U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, targeting almost all sectors of Tehran's economy and cutting nearly all dividends from the nuclear agreement for Iran. He also referred to the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iran, saying the embargoes are affecting the most vulnerable people in the country.
The United States claim that humanitarian goods are exempt from sanctions is an absolute lie. As an example, even today, we cannot easily import medicine for relieving the breathing problems of those injured by chemical weapons, which were provided by some Western countries to Saddam and used by him during his aggression against Iran.
The Iranian ambassador reiterated Tehran's stance that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against the UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more.
Takravanchi further said that the deal cannot be linked to anything outside of the nuclear program, such as Iran's missile capabilities.
To develop a conventional missile program is an inherent right of any country under international law, and Iran is no exception. Consequently, Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program.
The Security Council session came a day after the foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the JCPOA held a virtual meeting and reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. China and Russia in particular call on the U.S. to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Iran. This comes more than 3 weeks after the Iranian parliament passed a bill that requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. Iran started scaling back some of its commitments a year after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal. Tehran has time and again rejected any preconditions for reviving the agreement, noting that it will go back to full compliance once all the other parties to the court uphold their own end of the deal.
Well, the U.S. has imposed new sanctions on Syria, targeting its central bank and several other entities, key advisors of President Bashar al-Assad, as well as his wife. are among those blacklisted. The U.S. also imposed sanctions on Assad and his wife Asma in June. Washington accuses Asma of using her charities and civil society organizations to consolidate Damascus's political and economic power. The U.S. has so far imposed several rounds of sanctions against the Syrian government, accusing it of cracking down on its people. Damascus has dismissed the accusation, says the U.S. measures target ordinary Syrians and hamper an ongoing reconstruction process following years of conflict. Activist and commentator Mimi Allah believes the U.S. policy on Syria will remain unchanged, regardless of who heads the White House.
I think that the U.S. essentially is indicating that, whoever the new administration is, or since they're moving from the Trump administration to a Biden administration, that they're continuing their efforts in Syria regardless. And when I say efforts, I mean their plan to destroy Syria. Since they can't put military pressure on Assad, other than occupying the northeast of the country and controlling the oil resources, they're placing sanctions. So essentially what they're trying to do is starve Syrians into submission. And what they want is for Syria to agree to a constitution that would create a Kurdistan and allow the U.S. to remain inside Syria permanently. And Syria is never going to do that. So unfortunately, this means that it's an indication that the U.S. is not ready to pull out of Syria. And they're going to have to do something to force them to pull out of Syria.
The UN General Assembly has adopted a resolution urging Israel to halt demolishing and confiscating Palestinian homes in the occupied territories. The resolution, among other things, urged Israel to cease destroying civilian and vital infrastructure in the occupied territories. The General Assembly adopted the measure following a report by one of its committees on the situation in those territories. Rights groups say a large number of Palestinians have been displaced this year as a result of continued Israeli demolitions. The regime says it destroys the structures that lack construction permits. Palestinians, however, reject this. They say the demolitions are aimed at expanding Israeli settlements that are illegal under international law. Tunisia says that it is not interested in establishing diplomatic relations with Israel, following reports that it may normalize ties with Tel Aviv. The Tunisian Foreign Ministry said the country's position will not be affected by international developments. The remarks follow reports by U.S. media saying Tunisia might be the next Arab nation to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. Morocco was the latest Arab state to sign U.S. brokered deals with Israel after the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan. On Tuesday, an Israeli envoy arrived in Rabat to meet the Moroccan king in the first direct flight between Israel and Morocco. Palestinians have strongly slammed normalization deals with Israel as a stab in their back and a betrayal of their cause. Pakistan says anti-Israeli sentiments inside the country and similarities between Palestinian and Kashmir disputes provide sufficient grounds to reject the UAE efforts to normalize Islamabad's ties with Tel Aviv regime. Pakistan's clear stance on this issue has come after its foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel,
a UAE home,
something which Islamabad rejected after the country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with the Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
A bomb attack has targeted a police car on the outskirts of Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Local media say a policeman was killed and two others were injured after their car was hit by a roadside bomb. No further details are available. There's been no claim of responsibility either. Violence has surged in Afghanistan in the past few months, especially in the capital, Kabul. A tally shows more than 130 people have been killed in the city over the past 2 months. The surge comes as the government is in talks with Taliban militants for a peace deal. Over the last 2 months, media representatives in Afghanistan have tolerated heavy losses as several journalists have been targeted in terrorist attacks in the country. The recent wave of the attacks on media staff has raised concerns about the safety of the journalists amid the growing violence in the country. Amin Alimi has more from Kabul.
Media workers have recently been a target for the violent attacks in Afghanistan. Afghan government has strongly and repeatedly condemned targeting media, blaming the Taliban militant group for such attacks. This is why the militants have largely rejected involvement in attacks against the journalists. Seven journalists were killed in 2019, and now official figures say at least 14 journalists have lost their lives in 2020, six of them killed only over the past 2 months. The Afghan government says it has arrested some figures who are involved in some cases of attacks on journalists. Government officials say one of the main causes behind terrorists' focus on targeting media activists is to hide their defeats in the battlefields.
Terrorists are after hiding their defeats in the battlefields by planting roadside bombs and killing Afghan civilians, including journalists. The Afghan security and defense forces have recently arrested some of those who were behind planting IEDs and targeting civilians.
In the meantime, media rights activists believe the government has failed to protect journalists against death threats coming either from terrorist groups, influential figures, and local commanders.
The rising violence against journalists in Afghanistan has increased our concerns. We are not safe even in big cities like Kabul, and this is because of government's low attention to this problem. In this case, we want the government to let us protect ourselves by our own measures.
Media rights bodies and journalists consider the emergence and growth of media in Afghanistan as a great achievement. They believe the Afghan government has to take strict measures to put an end to the violence against journalists, who are in fact the frontline soldiers of press freedom. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Boris Johnson is facing intense pressure to impose another national lockdown within days, as more than 40 countries banned arrivals from the United Kingdom in an effort to keep out a new fast-spreading variant of coronavirus. Government scientific advisers warned that inaction could cost tens of thousands of lives and risk an economic, human and social disaster, with a new strain spreading across the United Kingdom and overseas. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Peter Walker, Natalie Grover, Daniel Buffy and Josh Halliday. The piece is titled, Calls for National Lockdown in England to Curb Spread of New COVID Strain. Boris Johnson is facing intense pressure to impose another national lockdown within days as more than 40 countries banned arrivals from the United Kingdom in an effort to keep out a new fast-spreading variant of coronavirus. Government scientific advisers warned that inaction could cost tens of thousands of lives and risk an economic, human and social disaster, with the new strain spreading across the United Kingdom as well as overseas. Ministers urged people to avoid panic buying food as France failed to lift its ban on freight and passengers from the United Kingdom on Monday, despite a personal appeal from the Prime Minister, who asked Emmanuel Macron to put aside his anxiety over the new strain of COVID-19. Speaking at a Downing Street press conference, Boris Johnson strived to reassure other world leaders that Britain has responded swiftly. I hope that everybody can see that as soon as we were briefed as a government of the fast transmissibility of this new strain, we launched all the necessary information with the World Health Organization, and we took prompt and decisive action the very next day to curb the spread of the variant within the United Kingdom, he said. Johnson said delays to cross-channel freight affected a small proportion of food entering the United Kingdom, as British supermarkets have said their supply chains are strong and robust, so everyone can continue to shop normally. Even so, some shoppers reported queues and empty shelves at various supermarkets. Downing Street insisted that measures imposed at the weekend, which placed London and areas in the south and east of England in a lockdown like Tier 4, but left people elsewhere still able to mix on Christmas Day, could control the spread of the new variant of COVID-19. But the message from health officials and scientists was very different. In a joint statement, Greater Manchester's directors of public health said anyone arriving in the region from a Tier 4 area or from Wales, which is also in effect in lockdown, should self-isolate for at least 10 days. Cases of the COVID mutation, which is thought to spread between people with up to 70% greater efficiency, have been detected across the United Kingdom. And Boris Johnson's chief scientific advisor said stronger curbs were likely. Speaking at a Downing Street press conference, alongside the Prime Minister, Sir Patrick Vallance said the new strain was everywhere and cases would rise after inevitable mixing at Christmas. The lesson I think you have to learn about this virus is that it's important to get ahead of it in terms of actions, Patrick Vallance said. I think it is likely that this will grow in numbers of the variant across the country, and I think it's likely, therefore, that measures will need to be increased in some places in due course, not reduced. Since news emerged at the weekend about the rapid spread of the new variant across parts of England, At least 42 countries have banned all flights from the United Kingdom, or said that only their nationals may be allowed in following a negative coronavirus test. They include Belgium, Italy, Austria, Germany, Spain, Portugal, Bulgaria, Hungary, Luxembourg, Slovakia, Poland, Romania, Switzerland, South Africa, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Croatia, France, Malta, Sweden, Turkey, Hong Kong, Canada, India, Russia, the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, Oman, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, El Salvador, Ireland, the Czech Republic, Colombia, Morocco, Chile, Finland, and Argentina. In a briefing on Monday, 21st of December, scientists said they had examined additional data and now had high confidence that the new strain had a transmission advantage over other virus variants circulating in the United Kingdom. We still don't understand the exact biological mechanism, said Peter Hornby, professor of emerging infectious diseases at Oxford University, who chairs the government's new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisory group, or NERVTAG. So there's still a lot of uncertainty about exactly how it's occurring and exactly the extent of the extra transmissibility. Other scientists said the variant was unlikely to be largely contained to south and east of England, and noted that the United Kingdom was heading towards the first wave peak of hospital admissions and deaths to accompany the added toll of winter on the National Health Service. A further 33,364 people were reported to have tested positive UK-wide on Monday, 21st of December, and 215 people died. As Boris Johnson confirmed that more than 500,000 people had received the first dose of the only approved COVID vaccine, scientists said harsher measures now could save lives of those yet to be immunized. Andrew Hayward, a professor of infectious disease epidemiology at University College London and a member of the government's Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, said the new variant had the potential to spread around the UK as well as overseas. I recognise that we have restricted travel from Tier 4 areas, but this transmission is not only in those Tier 4 areas. It's there at some level across the country, he said. Andrew Hayward added, we're just entering a really critical phase of this pandemic, and it makes absolute sense to act decisively, I would say, across the country, as many other countries have done, despite them not, as far as we know, being affected by this strain. Asked if it would be advisable to have a national lockdown, Andrew Hayward said, personally, I think it's clearer to give a consistent national message, because although the level of risk are different in different parts of the country, they're still there and they're still substantial. Essentially, what we're really doing is very much trying to reduce transmission until we can protect as many of the vulnerable as possible. And that would buy us more weeks in which we could get people vaccinated. I couldn't give you a precise estimate, but my view is that it will be in the scale of tens of thousands of lives. An increase in transmissibility, even given exactly the same mortality rate per person, will lead to many, many more deaths unless one increases the effectiveness of our control measures. Robert West, Professor of Health Psychology at University College London's Institute of Epidemiology and Health, who sits on the Advisory Group on Behavioural Science for SAGE, said his personal opinion was that the current system was unlikely to contain the spread of the virus. He said, we need to reset our strategy and move rapidly to a zero COVID strategy of the kind that many have been proposing. This will involve stricter but more rational social distancing rules across the country, and finally doing what we should have done from the start, to build the kind of test, travel, isolate and support programs they have in countries in the Far East. It sounds expensive, but the alternative could well be a catastrophic collapse in confidence in the country's ability to control the virus and the economic, human and social disaster that would follow. Asked why Tier 4 measures were not being pushed out across England, Boris Johnson's spokesman said, "I would point to the fact that we've been clear that people shouldn't be travelling out of Tier 4 areas, and I would point to the changes that we have made in terms of Tier 4, he said. We're being clear that people should remain at home and limit human interaction. Asked whether the House of Commons could be recalled to allow any angry MPs to debate the new measures, the spokesman said this would only be done to ratify any Brexit deal. If we need to recall Parliament for the purpose of Brexit, we will."
The debate.
Welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najaf. In a virtual meeting on Monday, top diplomats of Iran, Germany, France, the UK, China, and Russia renewed commitment to preserving the Iran nuclear deal. They also want Washington to return to the deal with no preconditions. Foreign Minister Zarif says that Britain, France, and Germany share the blame with the U.S. for irreparable harms to Iranians. At the same time, Iranian MPs want the Rouhani administration to install cascades of advanced centrifuges and raise uranium enrichment. They have given a two-month ultimatum for Tehran to start enjoying economic benefits under the nuclear accord. That's what we'll be discussing in this debate show.
Foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and world powers have reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. During a virtual meeting, China and Russia called on the United States to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Tehran.
"The United States should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally as soon as possible. It should also lift the sanctions against Iran, third-party entities, as well as individuals. And on this basis, Iran should fully resume its nuclear commitments."
Following the meeting, Iran's foreign minister said the Iran-EU declining trade data from 2014 to 2019 proved that the European signatories to the nuclear deal have gravely breached their commitments under the accord. Mohammad Javad Zarif said Britain, France and Germany should share the blame with the U.S. for what he called irreparable harm to Iranians. He said the trio has a last chance to save the pact. This comes about a month after the Iranian parliament gave a two-month chance to the West to lift the sanctions on Iran by overwhelmingly voting yes to a draft bill dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to lift sanctions. It requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. The plan, among other things, requires the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to produce and stockpile at least 120 kilograms of enriched uranium with a 20% purity level annually within 2 months after the adoption of the law. The parliament adopted the measure in the wake of the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which Iran blames on Israel. Ironically, Europeans once again failed to condemn the targeted killing of yet another Iranian scientist. In recent weeks, Europeans were found expressing hopes for a possible return of the U.S. to the JCPOA as President-elect Joe Biden is preparing to take office next month. However, their stance remains dubious with regard to the Iran deal, as they are now talking about revitalizing the accord if Iran negotiates on its missile program. However, Iran has stressed that it will not accept any preconditions in returning to the nuclear deal and will not negotiate its missile program or regional activities. Tehran says the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed and is coming to an end.
Well, that was Mehdi Fahmy reporting. Now, joining me in this debate will be Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, out of Budapest, and also Director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Tarabi from the Iranian city of Qom. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Budapest. George, Iran's top diplomat blames the European signatories of the JCPOA for little trade ties with Europe. The financial mechanism that they launched, known as Zinstex, has not done much to facilitate trade and banking transactions as it was supposed to do. What's the EU side of the nuclear deal going to do this time?
Well, the Iranians are interested in Iran because when the JCPOA was signed, it was always seen that at some point the United States would walk away. And so Iran was given assurances that should the United States walk away, should the United States impose sanctions, the Europeans, European signatories to the JCPOA, would make up for it. They would actually, you know, so in other words, Iran wouldn't lose anything as a result of the United States withdrawal from the JCPOA. Well, that never materialized. Trade between the Europeans and Iran is now lower than it was before the JCPOA was signed. So the Iranians are understandably very frustrated about this, and they are obviously rather annoyed with all this high-handed talk. Well, the United States will return to the JCPOA if Iran does this, 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 and this, and this. Well, Iran wasn't the one who walked away from the agreement. Iran wasn't the one who violated the agreement. So why should Iran undertake to do things that it was never supposed to undertake in accordance with the JCPOA to which Iran had adhered?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Now, Sam, the remaining parties to the nuclear deal are asking Washington to go back to the JCPOA from which President Trump pulled his country out unilaterally. And that, of course, without any preconditions. Now, what do you expect Joe Biden to do?
Well, actually, I have to say that what we heard today from Dr. Zarif was a very clear statement of Iran's position. It's a continuation of what Dr. Zarif spoke about when he was in the Euromed discussions. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear, and he also tweeted it, where this is the last chance for the Europeans and for the U.S. to do whatever they need to do for the JCPOA. And, you know, last chance means last chance, inshallah, hopefully. Because basically what we saw, especially in Dr. Zarif's tweet, he laid out the points that in detail, which I'm not going to repeat here because of time. But basically, he made a very important point. He said to the Europeans that democracies, and he put the word democracies in quotation marks, cannot ask Iran not to implement the law of the parliament that the parliament has passed. So basically, this last chance is going to be less than 2 months that the Europeans and the Americans have. In less than 2 months, the government will implement the new law. Dr. Zarif said the same thing in the Euromed conference. And so this is what's in front of us now. And the question is, and it's not even a question, I think, it's maybe a rhetorical question, is who really believes that the Americans and the Europeans are going to do in 2 months what they haven't done in, you know, a number of years? So this is the reality. The reality is that the Americans and the Europeans will not do what they were supposed to do all these years in these 2 months. As Dr. Zarif stated in his tweet, the Iranian people must, and he capitalized must, feel that there is a sanctions relief and that the sanctions are lifted. This clearly will not happen in the next 2 months. And in 2 months, the law that was passed by the parliament will be implemented. And it could be that we live in a world where Iran never leaves the JCPOA technically, but practically there is no such thing as the JCPOA.
It's less than 2 months. There's only 1 month left. Yeah, Georgia, Tehran has negated renegotiating the nuclear deal on grounds that there has been no give and take, and that's the natural outcome of any deal. And Iran did comply to the letter, as you know, of the agreement, but did not benefit economically, as it was supposed to under the accord. Now, what can be done to avoid the repeat of such an action on the part of the EU?
Well, I mean, obviously, what could be done is the United States returning to the JCPOA unconditionally and lifting sanctions unconditionally. Whether that will happen is, of course, extremely doubtful. But it's very hard to see why Iran would want to start complying with all sorts of requirements that were no part of the JCPOA when the states that are demanding this of Iran have themselves not adhered to the JCPOA. So the United States obviously hasn't adhered to it by walking out unilaterally. The Europeans haven't adhered to it by not compensating Iran for the economic hardship it suffered as a result of the United States withdrawal. So the Europeans and the Americans are not in compliance, and now they're demanding that Iran start adhering to all sorts of conditions that were no part of the JCPOA, and which incidentally are unreasonable demands, because after all, Iran does need ballistic missiles. I mean, Iran requires them for its security. I mean, Iran has been threatened by the United States. It has been attacked by the United States. It has been repeatedly threatened by Israel. Iran should have the means of defending itself. And the same goes for its being a regional power. I mean, it clearly has an interest in ensuring the security of Syria and Lebanon. Iran cannot just give up on these things. So these requests are absurd, and Iran will rightly reject them.
Now, Sam, the incoming U.S. president has promised to take his country back to the nuclear deal and also lift the sanctions, while also hinting at more negotiations on Iran's missile program and what it calls regional influence. Now, Tehran has asserted time and again it does not intend to negotiate its missile program. It serves as a deterrent. And also, for your information, we just had this news that Israel's Western-supplied submarines just passed the Suez Canal. It's heading toward the Persian Gulf. So why should Iran in such condition, you know, compromise its defensive capabilities while it's facing military threats from Israel and the U.S.?
Well, clearly it's not going to do it, just as my colleague said. The point is this. Iran, through its foreign minister, in an official meeting at ministerial level, has declared and told the other participants, the Europeans and the Americans, that this is their last chance. So the question is, will Dr. Zarif and the current administration in Iran have the courage to end this game, this so-called process, when this last chance is missed by the Americans and the Europeans, which it will be missed? There might be some cosmetic things that are done, there might be some statements, but none of the things that Iran has been demanding for years is going to be implemented by any of the other parties in the next 2 to 3 months. So this is the question. Will the JCPOA effectively end in the government that signed it, in the administration that signed it? Or will this administration just simply wait until its term is over and we have a new government, a new administration in Iran in June, and this will go down in history as one of the many failures of this administration, many of the unkept promises that this administration had? The issue is not to beat on this administration, to beat up on this administration. The point is that many things were said 8 years ago by the president and by the foreign minister, and none of them happened. So this is something that we have to learn from. There was a decision by the Iranian state to enter into a strategic negotiation with the West. It actually started 20 years ago with the goal of normalizing economic relations with the West. The result after 20 years is that this didn't happen. And a big reason for that is that the people in Iran pursuing this path did not have a clear understanding of the reality of what the U.S. is, and a clear understanding that the Europeans are basically vassals of the United States. They do not have the power to defend their own interests. It is in Germany's and Europe's interest to have independent economic and strategic relations with Iran, but they are not capable of doing that. And this is a deep issue, this is a deep civilizational and historical issue of the Europeans post-World War II. So, we have a generation in Iran who grew up at a time where the only alternative in the world was the West. This is, if you look back, late 80s, early 90s, this whole way of thinking started at that time in Iran. The world of 2020 is very different than the world of 1989 or 1991. There are alternatives for Iran besides the West. And what's very interesting, and something that's very rarely reported, is that the one group in Iran which has always been a champion for relations with the West, which is those who are involved in business in the industrial field, not consumer products, industrial products, who maybe for generations, one, two, three generations, have had relations with the West, they themselves have given up on the West, and especially on Europe, when they saw how the Europeans were not able to defend economic interests that they had established over decades. So, the Iranians, the elites in Iran, have now come to the point where they have alternatives to the West, which they didn't have 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. They entered this process, and history has recorded that this process has failed for Iran. That the Westerners bring in countries into processes, the peace process with the Palestinians, the whatever process you want to call this that we had with the West, this is nothing new. But process in itself has no benefit or profit for Iran. The goal of all this was to lift sanctions and to normalize economic relations. Mm-hmm. It hasn't happened, and it won't happen.
Okay, George, as Sam also mentioned in his comments a few minutes ago, recently the Iranian legislators have passed this bill that pushes the Rouhani administration to further enrich uranium and make use of more advanced centrifuges, etc. Now, they insist that they want an end to what they call the one-sided game to which Iran adhered even more than 2 years after Washington left it without benefiting much from it. Let's have your comments on this.
Well, it's very understandable that the Parliament has insisted on this, and I think it's that it's a right course for Iran to take. Iran is a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It is entitled to all of the benefits of a peaceful use of nuclear energy. Iran does not, never has had a nuclear weapons program, has no interest in nuclear weapons, and it gave up. Unilaterally gave up its nuclear energy program in return for commercial, economic, financial relations with the West. And as my colleague has pointed out, that never materialized. Well, since it never materialized, then Iran obviously has to pursue a different course. I think it should basically accept the JCPOA is no more, it's just history, and move along a different path. And it is entitled to the peaceful use of nuclear energy, and it does have economic partners that it can get around, whatever the hardships. I mean, there's no question. I mean, given the power of the dollar, the U.S. sanctions have hurt Iran, very seriously hurt Iran. But Iran does have other options. It has partners in Russia and China, both of whom have an interest in essentially moving away from this unipolar world order where the United States basically dominated militarily and financially and economically, and therefore they have an interest in helping Iran out. So I think, I think that it's understandable that the Iranian parliament has decided that a different course would yield much better results than they'd embarked on 20 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Now, some Tehran argues that West Asia's crises and arms are mainly imported from the U.S., U.K., France, and Germany, and these countries are selling billions of, tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons to their allies in this region annually, and they are expecting Iran to curtail its defense capabilities. How can they?
I think Dr. Zarif said it best when he told the German foreign minister to shut up. It's Dr. Zarif said. Basically, you know, it's the height of hypocrisy, and I think it doesn't even require us to discuss this very deeply, the total moral depravity of the West when it talks about these things. If you look at Yemen, if you look at all the decades that these issues that exist with the Palestinians, and all the wars that we all of us experienced in this region because of what they did. And so, as was mentioned by my colleague, obviously Iran has a strategic deterrence, and it has now moving from a regional strategic deterrence to a global strategic deterrence. Again, these issues are often not mentioned in Western media, but Iran has officially declared that it has ICBM capability. So we're going to be in a world in a very short time where Iran has strategic deterrence on a global level, where the Americans and the Europeans have to deal with an Iran that cannot be threatened with all options at the table, because if one of the options is used, then the option for Iran will be to retaliate in kind.
Okay.
And this is the big lesson that we have to learn, which is if you're going to enter into strategic negotiations with the West, you have to have strategic deterrence, which means missiles and submarines, because you mentioned submarines, and other military hardware that is able to create strategic deterrence.
Okay, appreciate your comments and contribution. We had a senior research fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, out of Budapest, and director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Tarabi from Bonn.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
To discuss Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the light of the month that we are in, who gave everything for humanity.
For humanity. My brother Yasir Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode for humanity, an episode in which we, or rather a program in which we try to dive and delve into the teachings of Islam has laid out for us as human beings. And in these few episodes that I've been given the privilege to, you know, be with you, we are discussing Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, certain events, certain teachings, certain things that we as human beings can extract from the mission of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, from the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And we are trying to delve into the concept of justice. And we have seen in our previous episodes that in order to truly understand what justice is, justice which is defined as the placing of a thing in its proper place, one thing that we should, you know, set out from the onset is that justice and equality are two different things. That in Islam we do not have equality, we have what is known as equity. Equality is what? Equality is that you give every single individual the same opportunity, the same of everything. Yes, there are certain places where this is relevant, where this can be done, but this is not justice. And the example that is always given when we study, for example, or we hear it from the members, and we hear it from the pulpit many times, that the concept of justice is not equality. That equality, for example, is that if a teacher teaches a particular class, give them specific orders, and a group of them, for example, follows those orders. They go, they study, they do their work. And a group doesn't. A group, you know, does their own thing. They ignore the teacher's advices. They play around. They don't do what is recommended of them or required of them. And then time comes for an examination or test. And then regardless of what the students did, the teacher gives all of them the equal mark. This is equality. And this is not justice. Justice is that giving the proper mark to the proper student based on the effort that that student has done. Not just say, oh, I'm being just, so I give everybody the same mark. No, this is not justice. Similarly, when it comes to social justice, this is not the same. Again, the social justice that we are aware of is that social justice, as I mentioned in our previous discussion, that looks at the human being just as a physical being. So everything there, yes, can be equal. Yes, for example, everybody has the right to food. Everybody has the right to education, and so on and so forth. But there are certain rights, for example, that, you know, there's no such thing as equality. Again, this goes back to fiqh and jurisprudence, and we don't want to get into it. But knowing that the concept of justice is not the same as the concept of equality. And Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, being that embodiment of justice, knew it. And therefore, one of the things that we should understand from Karbala, from Ashura, is that the Imam did not stand up for equality, and it should not be taken. No, the Imam stood up for what is known as equity or justice, adl, putting everything in its proper place. Now, going back to our discussion, we see that a human being in the Islamic picture, in the Islamic mold, contains two dimensions. One is his physical dimension, one is a spiritual dimension. The movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam catered for both. That we see that before the Imam decided to leave Medina and go to Mecca, and then leave Mecca when? On the 8th of Dhul Hijjah, the Imam left and went towards Kufa. Why were the people of Kufa writing letters to the Imam? One is because they saw that the physical thing that was happening to them, or the physical injustice that was occurring to them, for example, torture, imprisonment, stipends, and their right and their, you know, livelihood from the Baytul Mal or the Islamic chest, if you like to call it, the Islamic finances, you know, the treasury, for example, the Islamic treasury, was not being given to them. Injustice were taking place on a physical level, on wealth. People were getting more because of lineage, because of their nationality, because of their association. So the Imam got these letters from the people of Kufa, on this level. But there is another thing also we need to understand, is that at that particular time, we see that the Islam and the Islamic teachings also were losing its value. People were not understanding the substance of Islam. Yes, there was a form, no doubt about it. People were coming for Hajj,